Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
our progressive liberals have done everything they can to use objects like Common Core and No Child Left Behind and the ADA as it pertains to education, amended in 2008. All of these things are nothing more than attempts to sugarcoat the baloney that gets them reelected so they can live off of us. The voting blocks that put them back in office over and over again are the ones who believe that they are entitled to everyone else's goods and money. When you promise people that no matter what their skills, their talents, their abilities, or their desire to put forth effort, they are guaranteed to have equal stuff in everybody's house, the ignorant and the foolish will run to your side, unable to wait to cast multiple ballots to keep you in office. If somebody promises me the moon and guarantees that I won't have to take care of it once I've got it, if I'm foolish and ignorant, I'd be very likely to vote for them too. But I am neither foolish nor ignorant. And I know darn good and well that if I have something, I am supposed to take care of it. And if I want something, I have to work to get it. Our public education system is operating on the equal outcomes principle that puts parents, teachers, administrators, and community members into an unsolvable dilemma. It requires the public schools to individually educate every child, working to that child's strengths and weaknesses, adjusting the curriculum and the way it is presented, so that every single child is being taught in the way that is most comfortable and successful for him or her. And according to the Department of Education and their love of data and tests, and graphs and charts and numbers, all of these individually educated children will progress and acquire knowledge at exactly the same rate. Because if they don't, the standards of learning tests that all of the states are required to administer will show drops in success rate, and the schools in those states will lose their federal funding, which means they will not have the budget to pay teachers to accommodate the fact that when you have a collaborative class with 40% special ed and 60% average children, you need anywhere from 2 to 5 adults in the classroom to make sure it doesn't degenerate into feeding time at the monkey house. In order to meet the requirements of all of these wonderful pieces of legislation that are to ensure equal outcomes, money is needed. Lots and lots and lots of money. And that money has to come from you and me, ladies and gentlemen, one way or the other. Either through the coercion of threat, of jail, or fines if we do not pay exorbitant taxes, or the imposition of hidden taxes that we don't notice, such as if you've ever looked at your phone bill, or your electric bill, or your gas bill, or your water bill. We are taxed to the point that even air is being subjected to tax. What do you think naming carbon dioxide as a pollutant does? Don't breathe out, anybody, because pretty soon that's going to come out of your paycheck too. And all of this money that's being poured into our public education system to guarantee these wonderful, impossible, equal outcomes has done nothing except make our public schools totally fail to do the job they were originally intended to do. Public education, as it was envisioned by our founding fathers, was to be the opportunity for all children, no matter their economic background, to gain the education to become a lifelong learner. Men like Franklin and Jefferson and Adams and Wythe and Mason and Sherman, who were part of the Continental Congress that got us our independence from Britain, and again part of the Constitutional Convention that gave us the framework of our republic, understood that the only way the republic could survive and prosper would be to have educated, informed, knowledgeable citizens who took their responsibility to choose their government seriously. They knew that education was the most important opportunity that any human being could have. Your life, your liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those God-given rights mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, cannot be attained if you are uneducated, if you are willfully or accidentally ignorant of what goes on in your world. If you do not have the skills that allow you to fulfill the American dream, the chance to have it better than your parents did by educating yourself, what happens to this republic? What happens to its society, its economy, its brilliance, its innovative genius, its pioneering spirit? It dies a whimpering, craven, dependent death in a slave collar. We are teaching our children not that effort and work and study will give them the opportunity for success. Oh no, we're not teaching them that at all. We are teaching them that they are so special that the world will lie down, roll over, and wag its tail simply because they exist. I deal with children, middle school children, every day of the week for 9 months a year. My job is to be the in-school suspension teacher in a middle school. What that means is that students who cannot behave appropriately and are referred to the principal and vice principal for disciplinary action are often sent to my classroom to spend one or more days as a punishment for inappropriate behavior. While they are there, they receive the classwork that they are missing by being out of their regular classes. They also receive additional work from me when they have completed all work assigned to them to their teachers in any or all of the four core subject areas that our public schools teach: mathematics, language arts, history, and science. When they are with me, they must abide by the rules of my classroom. These rules are considered to be incredibly strict and a huge part of the punishment inflicted upon them. My rules are as follows. In my classroom, you must raise your hand and wait to be called upon before you speak. You must remain in your assigned seat, and if you are asked to change seats, you must do so quickly and courteously. You must put forth effort on your work. If you do not understand anything, you may raise your hand and ask for help. I do not do the work for you, but I will help you understand it. I cannot help you when you are taking a test or a quiz, but if you do have one scheduled, I will give you study time during which you may ask for help or clarification on any of the material upon which you will be tested. If all students complete their assignments, if they behave courteously and appropriately in my class, then at the end of the day, they can earn up to 20 minutes of what I call free talk time, when they can remain in their seats and talk to one another, so long as they avoid what I call the three P's: pejoratives, pornography, and profanity. In other words, they are allowed to talk with one another so long as they avoid nasty, insulting comments about anyone. They don't discuss their sexual lives, and they do not use profane language. This horribly strict environment, this equivalent to the Roman galleys or the prisons of France from which Jean Valjean escaped in Les Misérables, is enough of a deterrent that most of them really don't want to be in there. But the other side of the coin, ladies and gentlemen, is that at least 80% of the students I deal with tell me, "You know, Ms. Rowland, I really don't like being in ISS, but I sure did get a lot done, and I learned stuff while I was here. I have been asked, or it has been implied to me by my supervisors and the administrators of my school, that they wish that I would get a provisional teaching license and go back to school and spend the money for education courses that would give me a teaching license permanently. And I have made it very clear that, no, I do not intend to do that. There are several reasons. Number one, I really don't want to be further in debt than I already am. And number two, I do not want to have to deal with the paperwork and the bureaucratic, bucolic byproduct forced upon teachers by the system. Nor do I wish to be in a classroom where at least 50 to 60% of class time is spent trying to get everyone to stop talking long enough to hear what I have to teach. My friend Yolanda says I am really wicked and mean because I require my students to carry on civilized conversations. She's right, I am. I've had several students, I've had it reported to me by other teachers, that several students have gone back to class and said, Mrs. Rowland is a really strict teacher. And then the funny part is, they usually add, but boy, she sure knows a lot. It's a compliment, ladies and gentlemen, both parts of it. When I was in school, my classroom rules were standard operating procedure. Granted, we weren't patted on the back and given candy or our own personal laptop or a one-on-one aide to shepherd us through the halls so we won't start fights, but we did sit quietly in class. Most of us did our work. We studied for tests. We raised our hand and waited to be called upon before we spoke so that each and every person had the floor and could say or ask what they needed to without interruption or a free-for-all, you know, coffee clatch, chat room, OMG atmosphere. My friend Linda said that she's glad when she was in school that we didn't have the technology of today. And in a way, so am I. There are aspects of technology that are a boon. Calculators would have given my husband the opportunity to become an engineer, and he would have been a darn good one, too. But my David was dyslexic. He never had any problem with math concepts. Arithmetic baffled him, though, because inevitably when he added a column of figures and came up with 21, he'd put down the 2 and carry the 1 and think it was fine. And he never did manage to get his times tables memorized past the 5s, but he could figure it out by adding if he needed to. Had calculators been available for him, he very likely would have gone on to college and instead of majoring in philosophy and religious studies with a minor in communication, he probably would have majored in engineering and been an architect or an electronical engineer or an aeronautical engineer or a marine engineer because he thought in those concepts. So some technology, if it's used properly, is a boon. As Glenn Beck has said before, technology is like fire. And you know what happened to Prometheus when he gave mankind the gift of fire, and the gods were angry. They chained Prometheus to a rock and had an eagle eat out his liver every day for daring to allow humankind to achieve godlike power with fire. Technology today can be a tremendous aid to students who have specific types of learning disabilities, whose intellectual ability is quite great, but whose processing ability has a hitch in its get-along. The downside is that I have so many students who are perfectly capable of memorizing arithmetic facts who pull out a calculator to add 3 plus 5 because they can't reliably get 8 doing it in their head. Not because they're incapable of memorizing math facts or understanding the concept of addition, but because they have become so addicted to the easy button that thinking or doing anything with your brain other than deciding which button to push is cruel and unusual punishment like my ISS room. This is the result, ladies and gentlemen, of the equal outcomes as averse to equal opportunity. Technology can be an aid to giving a child with great intellectual ability and specific disabilities the opportunity to show his or her intelligence and not be downgraded, denigrated, or shuffled off to the side because of one difficulty that can be surmounted with a simple technological device. But when you start accommodating for specific difficulties, it's very difficult to deny that accommodation to everybody else in the class. And this is what happens with our current philosophy that we need to have collaborative education and make everybody the same in the classroom so that everybody will feel good about themselves and no one will feel embarrassed or inadequate because they don't think as fast, write as fast, or understand as well as somebody else. What you get when you attempt to artificially create an equal outcome, you get an equal outcome, all right. You get the outcome that nobody bothers to use their brain. My friend Linda in the chat room said that she feels sorry for kids today because they have nowhere near the kind of freedom that we did when we were young, and she's correct. They have freedoms we don't. They have access to information at their fingertips in their own bedrooms that we had to make a special trip to the library to get a hold of and hope and pray that everybody else hadn't already checked out the books that we needed for our research paper. But the freedom to think, the freedom to go outside and explore without fear, the freedom to believe that their neighborhoods were safe and that the strangers they met were probably going to be friendly, but all you had to do was find a policeman and he would help you. The freedom to examine and think about what you learned and talk about it. The freedom to choose your path in academics. The freedom to sit under a tree and read because you were taught how. Those things are no longer there because of the belief that we can regulate children into equal outcomes. That all we have to do is to make more laws and more regulations and create more agencies, and we'll have everybody exactly alike. And nobody will feel bad because someone else is better at something than they are. A few months ago, I read a short story on this program called Harrison Bergeron by the science fiction author Kurt Vonnegut. Some of you may remember it. It is an ironic piece that basically describes the inevitable outcome of the progressive view of equal stuff in everybody's head. Harrison Bergeron, the main character, if you will, was superlative in every way in a society in which people were given artificial electronic handicaps so that if they were intellectually, artistically, or physically gifted, they couldn't perform to the best of their ability because someone else would feel embarrassed or put down because they couldn't do it as well. The concept of fairness, which my friend Linda just mentioned, we hear from our president over and over and over again, is more of that bucolic byproduct, that bologna coated with sugar. The only way we have fairness, ladies and gentlemen, is if we as individuals are fair. It cannot be imposed upon us by regulation. In any society, no matter how regulated it is and how controlled it is, example, communist China, Soviet Russia, Cuba, people, human beings, are going to have different degrees of ability, different interests, different perspectives, different life experiences, different genetic heritages, different physical attributes, different body shapes, different eye color, different skin color, different hair color, different degrees of immune system success. And without eugenics, that will always be the case. The underlying poison in all this sugar coating of fairness is the open door to eugenics, which progressives have been trying to implement ever since the late 1800s and early 1900s. People like Margaret Sanger, whom our former Secretary of State, Madam Clinton, admires so much, was a proponent, an outspoken proponent of eugenics. She believed that all the inferior races should be allowed to die out by imposing involuntary sterilization upon them so that the human race could be improved and all of these dead weight lesser peoples could be gotten rid of. Her ideas fueled Hitler's and Mengele's experiments and the extermination of the Jews and the indigenous peoples of Central Europe, like the Gypsies, and even good old Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on doors and handing out tracts. What most people aren't educated enough to understand is that when you attempt to redesign humanity through government regulation and government control, you inevitably lead to a society in which there is no innovation and there is no creativity, because innovation and creativity come from individuality. And individuality includes such things as learning disabilities, physical handicaps, impairments of some sort. Alexander Graham Bell's research that developed the telephone began because his mother was deaf. That's correct. He researched sound and the amplification of sound because he was trying to find a way to help deaf people hear, because his own mother could not. If she had been bred out of the population, we would not have a telephone. Because the spark that lit the fire that created the technology that you carry around in your hand and text people with came from someone who wanted to provide something to help someone do better. Cochlear implants, ladies and gentlemen, okay, that help the deaf hear. Even eugenicists should have enough brains to understand that no matter how well they breed out any type of genetic abnormality, unless they wrap us all in cotton and stick us in a box, accidents happen. And people lose abilities like hearing or sight. Or they suffer brain injuries that damage their cognitive abilities or their motor skills. Eugenicists, progressives, Fabian socialists would just, you know, quietly kill them. Why waste the money and the time and the effort? It's that old bugbear of unintended consequences, ladies and gentlemen. Progressives do not or will not understand that the vast majority of our innovative technological miracles arise from the desire to fix something, not eliminate it, not destroy it, but fix it. If we create the kind of equal outcome society that progressives are so much in love with. We will doom the human race to extinction. The reason we are still here and have not gone the way of the dinosaur and the dodo bird and the passenger pigeon and any other extinct species is because we adapt. We are the bipedal version of the coyote, ladies and gentlemen. Coyotes are still around and they're considered pests because they adapt. They figure out a way to live near and among people who have taken over what was their wilderness and their hunting ground. They adapt. And so do we. Redesigning the human race into the progressive ideal of Brave New World. You know, that old test tube of mine, you know, that old bottle of mine. Any of you who ever read Brave New World, everybody is basically test tube babies bred for their specific role in the society. Nothing will ever be discovered, invented, or created. Because when you kill individuality, your only recourse is to become the Borg. You cannot invent anything, so you assimilate those who still can. And what happens when you've assimilated everybody you can get your hands on? What do you have? A dead and empty universe full of mechanistic, non-thinking beings who are not alive in any sense of the word. Equal outcomes is another synonym for risk-free, perfectly safe life. Again, another impossibility. To be alive, ladies and gentlemen, is to face risk every moment of every day. Living includes the possibility of not living anymore. That is inevitable. All living things eventually die. Hopefully, before they do, they might figure out a way to make their dying a little further in the future and their living helpful to someone else. But if you eliminate individuality in the name of making everybody feel good about themselves, you eliminate the species. I am not endorsing or advocating the kind of let's get rid of anybody who's defective so we'll all be perfect thinking pattern of progressives. By saying we shouldn't have special education in our schools, we shouldn't accommodate children with difficulties, we shouldn't try to help them go as far as they can, far from it. I believe in equal opportunity. And that's the key word, opportunity. Unfortunately, all of the accommodations and desire for equal outcomes and everybody should go to college and the Americans with Disabilities Act that amended, which I will read for you right now, states that a disability, according to the amendment, is anything that impedes or limits a major life activity. And major life activities include, but are not limited to, caring for oneself, performing manual tasks, seeing, hearing, eating, sleeping, walking, standing, lifting, bending, speaking, breathing, learning, reading, concentrating, thinking, communicating, and working. Those are all major life activities. Those aren't all of them. Those are just all of the ones that if any of those things is impaired, you have a disability. And it also includes any impairment of major bodily functions. Okay? Including, but not limited to, functions of the immune system, normal cell growth, digestive, bowel, bladder, neurological, brain, respiratory, circulatory, endocrine, and reproductive functions. And if an individual is mistreated under the Americans with Disabilities Act, in other words, not given something that the act says they're supposed to have, because that person is perceived to have a disability, even if they don't, that person is still entitled to recompense for having been perceived as disabled, even if they're not disabled, and denied something because somebody thinks they are. And that's being regarded as having such an impairment. So if somebody discriminates against you because they think you have an impairment, then even if you don't have an impairment, you're still impaired because they think you are. And entitled to legal recompense for being discriminated against for an impairment you don't have. So if I am, I guess I'm disabled, folks. I've had a complete hysterectomy. So my reproductive system isn't there anymore. So that means, since I'm disabled, that anybody who denies me the opportunity to be a surrogate mother, because I don't have the organs to do it with, okay, is probably violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I could see somebody suing somebody under federal law that they have been denied the right to do something, to be paid to carry another woman's egg, fertilized embryo, because they are impaired and don't have the equipment to do it with. Or I can see somebody saying to, my sister, who had one ovary removed because she had an ovarian cyst, that she could not be a surrogate mother because it would be perceived that the other ovary probably didn't work since there was only one of it, and so therefore, no, you can't do this. So she could probably sue them and say, wait a minute, you are regarding me as if I have a disability and denying me the right to earn money in a legal way because of your view of the fact that I am disabled. Because reproductive capability is, lack of reproductive capability is apparently a disability. I am not kidding you, ladies and gentlemen. This is in the amended Americans with Disabilities Act that was signed into law by our current president in 2008. And as it pertains to education, there's another little interesting sidelight too. Did you know that not only adults can receive Social Security disability income, so can children. If children are determined to be disabled, and disabilities automatically include things like AIDS, Down syndrome, a few other conditions, being weighing less than 2 pounds at birth, that's another one, they are automatically considered eligible for Social Security supplemental income if their parents' income is such that it doesn't exceed a certain dollar amount. So that means for people who are in the lower income tier, if they can get their child labeled as disabled, they can apply for Social Security supplemental income, which is supposed to be used to accommodate the disability of the child. We have several disabled children in our school whose parents are low income. And oh yes, they receive FSSI. And I know of one case where the child in question was sent to school with a feeding tube and a vaginal catheter and filthy. And another child who was sent to school with diapers that hadn't been changed in 3 days. But their parents received SSSI because they had a disabled child. You may have noticed on the news, if you watch Fox, none of the other news org outlets would have mentioned it, that you must have noticed the incredible increase in the filing of disability claims since the economy's downturn. Disability, Social Security disability, is there, or was originally put there, primarily for people who could not work and earn enough to sustain themselves because of some form of illness, physical difficulty, or whatever. My husband was one of those because he couldn't work. The need is very real. And yes, we should have a safety net for people who, through no fault of their own, are hit by illness or accident or traumatic injury and cannot come back enough to be able to do work that will sustain them. It used to be the responsibility of the community to help one another in these cases. It used to be the responsibility of the religious organizations within a community to be charitable toward those who could not care for themselves or could not work. And it was true charity, caritas, love. What we have now is dependency. The way that it's set up, if you try to work, and you cannot do it, you lose your disability while you are working if you make too much money. If you cannot work after you have tried, you have to go through the whole process again. So you're much better off not even bothering to try. Benjamin Franklin there's a quote attributed to Benjamin Franklin, and I don't know whether it's actually Franklin who said it, but the quote has value. You do not eliminate poverty by making it comfortable to be poor. You eliminate poverty by making it uncomfortable to be poor. We are spending our time making it comfortable to be poor and disabled, so that there is no incentive to try to use what you do have to take care of yourself. I used to work in a tutoring firm, did for over 20 years, and I had a student, an adult student, who came to me for assistance with his reading because he wanted to better himself. He had received Social Security disability because he was injured when he was a very young man in school in a silly, stupid duel with pencils. Somebody jabbed one into his kneecap and he was permanently impaired. He couldn't walk correctly. So there were many things, physical things, that he could not do. And he did not have the education or the intellectual capacity to do the kind of work that didn't require physical movement to that degree. Well, he got tired of being dependent. So he turned down his Social Security disability and went to work as a dishwasher. And he was on his feet, and he hurt a great deal. But he wanted to better himself. So he walked 6 miles from his home to our tutoring center and paid for tutoring to improve his reading so he could attend community college and get an associate's degree that would allow him to apply for a better job. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what the safety net is supposed to do. To give you something to sustain you while you pull yourself up and manage to find something you can do within your limits. Not because somebody pays you to sit home and eat Cheetos and watch television, but because somebody pays you to feed yourself until you can figure out how you can make a living. And it comes back to education again, ladies and gentlemen, as it always does. Education is not a right, ladies and gentlemen. It is a good. There is a difference. A good is a desirable thing. Something that is beneficial, that is wanted, that has value to an individual. A car is a good. It is not a right. But we have been swallowing the progressive idea that education, their kind, is a right. Their kind of education means guaranteed success in academia and the material world, no matter what your abilities are. Well, that's not what education is, ladies and gentlemen. Education is not babysitting for 12 years so somebody gets a piece of paper that says they're qualified to do a job, and then being babysat on the job because if you fire them because they're incompetent, you are discriminating against a disabled person. We are destroying ourselves from the ground up, quite literally, with the way we purport to educate our kids. We aren't educating them. We are doing anything but educate them. We are giving them happy pills in the form of grades that they have not earned and promotions that they cannot take advantage of. The number of kids that get passed through the system for 12 years, come out of high school, incompetent to do anything whatsoever except possibly hunt deer on daddy's acres or repair daddy's car with supervision, and who get fired from McDonald's because they think, I don't feel like going to work today, is a viable excuse for not showing up. And yeah, a lot of them do that. And because the caliber of the workforce produced by our public education system has fallen so much over the last 35 years, everybody in the workforce is presumed to be incompetent and stupid. Because unfortunately, so many of them are. And because they are, and because our businesses are being crippled by government mandates, businesses cannot exist and provide jobs if they cannot be profitable. And they cannot be profitable if, in order to meet the expectations of government, they have to charge for their product of service more than people can afford to pay, they are not going to be able to remain in business. Which means all those people who they have to give a job to won't have a job because the business won't be there. And all those people will be thrown right back into the dependent entitlement society where they'll be on government funds, SSSI, Social Security Disability, unemployment, whatever it is, because the government is supposed to take care of you and protect you. And make sure that you never, ever have to suffer any consequences for anything you do. Because it would be mean and unfair if you had to take the consequences of your own incapacity to put forth effort or learn. We have come an incredibly long way in our global civilization, ladies and gentlemen, from the days of the rapacious, piratic capitalists of the late 19th and early 20th century who used and threw away their workforce because there were always more warm bodies to tend the machine. We no longer think of people that way. But we have tilted so far in the opposite direction that we are creating a generation, now the second generation, of people who assume that anything that doesn't come easily should be given to them simply because they shouldn't have to put forth any effort to get it. And that anybody who has more of anything than they do obviously got it by taking it from somebody else and should give it back to them because it isn't fair that they should have more. Well, guess what? It isn't fair that my husband is dead and I'm alone. But it is life. And it is the risk you take when you love. When you put your heart in someone else's hands and they put theirs in yours. Loving and living are a risk, ladies and gentlemen. No one lives forever. No one is guaranteed a risk-free life. No one is guaranteed that every moment of his day will be filled with nothing but good. No one is guaranteed that the rain will never fall at the wrong time. No one is guaranteed that the guy who is drunk driving down the road cannot possibly hit you and kill you because government will jump between the two cars and stop him. Fairness is a concept that works very well in an artificial environment like a card game or a board game or a football field or a baseball diamond. Fairness is a concept that is absolutely necessary in a game, ladies and gentlemen. But in spite of all the rah-rah, sis-boom-bah, pretty speeches, coach firing you up, mannerisms of progressive liberals. Life is not a game with clear-cut rules and fairness for everybody and that ridiculous level playing field. Because life is lived by individual human beings. And each and every one of us has our flaws and our brilliance. No two of us are alike. No two of us want exactly the same things out of this risk called life. No two of us will do exactly the same things to get what we want. But because we have lived in a society in which the right of the individual to determine his own fate is sacrosanct, we can doggone well try. We can have the opportunity to go as far and fly as high as our desire and our skills and our abilities and our effort will take us. And no more than that can be guaranteed to anyone by any institution of mankind. The strength and the beauty of this nation and its structure is that it has done something that no civilization in the history of mankind has ever done before it. It has managed to find the balance between the safety of society as a whole and the freedom of the individual. We have done that, ladies and gentlemen. But now we are facing a group of people who have a great deal of power, who are determined that that society, that balance between those things must be disrupted, because that balance between the ability of an individual to have the opportunity and the safety of society stops them from the ultimate power they seek. They cannot control the members of a society like that. And control and power, synonyms, same thing, are what they desire. They are not interested in the betterment of the human race, no matter what they tell you in the pretty speeches. They are interested in power and control only. Redesigning the world to their vision, with them in the driver's seat and you, the horse, pulling the carriage. Because you, ordinary citizen that you are about as important to them as the workhorse they use. And if something happens to you, there are plenty more horses out there who can't wait to get in line to pull the carriage for the bag of oats at the end of the trip. We are educating our children, ladies and gentlemen, to believe that they are entitled to anything and everything they want. Progressives have a difficulty differentiating between a want and a need, just as they do between a right and a good. To progressives, wants and needs are the same thing. I want the same kind of car my neighbor has. The fact that my neighbor is a brilliant neurosurgeon who works 70 hours a week and went to school for 7 extra years after college to master his craft and saves people's lives and is paid commensurate with the importance of what he does, doesn't matter. He's got that car and I don't. It's not fair. I want what he has. And it's government's job to take it away from him and give it to me, or make it impossible for either one of us to have that car and both of us have a smart car that we plug in and only drive 20 miles before it stops. Because nobody gets to have more than his share of the zero-sum pie. Progressives are very poor mathematicians, ladies and gentlemen. They do not understand that there is unlimited power in the universe, an unlimited economic power in free markets and capitalism. When someone attains wealth, generally they don't attain it by taking it away from somebody else. Generally, they attain it by being smarter or better at something than somebody else, or working harder. But that kind of understanding doesn't buy you votes from the people who want things they haven't earned. It doesn't buy you votes from the people who don't think, they only react, and are much easier to sway and persuade to go into the voting booth and pull the lever they're told to pull. Those who are ignorant of history, because they're ignorant of just about anything, except I want, gimme. If you are not ignorant of history, You know of Tammany Hall. You know of the political machines of the 1890s and early 1900s in the major cities. The immigrant population, who were taken care of by the party bosses, and like good little sheep, went to the polls and voted to keep those same party bosses in power, because they knew that if the party bosses stayed in power, they would be taken care of. Their kids would have food. They'd have a job. If they went against the party bosses, they would not. So would they vote themselves out of the things they needed and wanted? Of course they wouldn't. The Tammany Hall politicians and the political machines of the 1880s, 90s, and early 1900s were actually better than what we've got now, because they did take care of their voting bloc. The party boss would send around a carton of food. If the good worker who always voted consistently for the Democratic Party in the local elections lost his job, they'd make sure that he could feed his family until he found another one, because they knew that he was how their bread got buttered. They didn't just encourage him to sit back and relax and do nothing but vote every 4 years. They actually gave value for the power they took. Our current politicians don't. They give nothing but dependency. They give nothing but the slave collar. They give nothing but sugar-coated lies. There is no way that anyone is going to rise from poverty if poverty is more comfortable than work. When people on the welfare rolls complain because their rent-adjusted housing apartment doesn't have a big enough HDTV because the government won't increase their check, you know there's something wrong. You know that we are doing everything we can, if we are following these people, to kill this nation and everyone in it. Quite literally. We are, unfortunately, facing what could be the literal end of our republic. Many of us see this, and many of us are out there doing everything we can to preserve it in whatever way we can. And I'm enough of an optimist to believe that we can succeed. We can, and we will. But I'm also enough of a realist to understand that it isn't going to happen with only words or only wishes or only prayer. God helps those who help themselves. And we have to get up out of our comfortable chairs, away from our comfortable televisions and our comfortable life, and out and slog around and wake people up. We have to stand up for what we believe. We have to take part in our community in a way that most people have forgotten, mainly because we have a very mobile population thanks to technology and the improvement in our ability to go from place to place and exchange information. People don't remain in the same community for all of their lives, as used to be the case. Even 40 years ago, that was the case. I remember traveling to New Mexico for Christmas one year with my sister and her husband and their baby and my dad and my other sister and me and my mom. And it was the first time my brother-in-law who was 26 or 27 at the time, had ever been out of the state of Virginia in his life. Yeah, his grandparents and his parents and he had lived in the same part of the same town in the same state. And why go anywhere else? So they were all there for each other. There was extended family to pull up, take up the slack. If somebody was ill, there was grandma or mom to take care of the kids. People had a sense that there was a web, a safety net in the community. Not because the government told them it takes a village and they were mandated to do it by living in nuclear houses all around a central power source and not going anywhere farther than 10 miles away in their electric cars, but because they had put down roots in a community and gotten to know the people who lived there. If you look at the electoral map from the last election and look at which states went to the Democratic candidates and which went to the Republican, you will see that those states which went overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party were the states with the largest urban centers. Jefferson hit the nail on the head when he said that we would be doomed as a society if we began to cram ourselves together in the cities. He understood that if you live in a city, even in his time, you begin to lose your independence and your self-reliance. Because many things that you would normally have to do for yourself in a more rural or suburban community, the city does for you. And you are prohibited by law from doing those things for yourself, even if you want to. You talk to anybody who lives in a city, and every single one of them will say, if the pipes are not working properly or their wallpaper, well, that's not my job. I'll call the landlord. I'll call the super. Yeah. If the front doorstep is dirty, well, I can't do that. That's the janitor's job. It's always somebody else's responsibility to maintain the infrastructure. That's this, the sugar-coated lie and all of this stimulus spending for the infrastructure. The infrastructure that the federal government is responsible for is very clearly delineated in the Constitution. And if the Supreme Court had not used the picket fence theory of precedence, and the regulate interstate commerce clause to absurdity, the federal government wouldn't be capable of ripping us off to that degree and spending the money on places like Solyndra, because they would not have the precedent to say it was okay under the Constitution. It isn't. Congress and the presidency were never given the power to fund businesses. One of the difficulties with being a widow now, I live in the country. I don't have city water, okay? I don't have street lights. I don't have buses or trams or subways. I have a car. I have a well. If my plumbing breaks, I got to find somebody to fix it or fix it myself. I had someone who could do that kind of thing, but he isn't with me anymore. So now I have to rely on my neighbors or pay to get a professional to do it because I don't have those skills. And to be quite frank, I don't have the physical strength to do some of the things that are required. I'm not 22 anymore. As much as I hate to admit it, I'm not. And I don't have the body and the strength and the stamina and the energy of a 22-year-old. By the end of the week, the stairs I climb to get from one floor to another at school have gone from being a molehill to the climbing Everest. By Friday, I swear the custodian has added more steps. It gets harder through the week. And I'm tired when I get home. But thank God I live in a community where people are good neighbors. And they help me. And I help them. We help each other. Not because government tells us we have to, but because it's the right thing to do. I help my neighbors because there will come a day, and there has come that day, when I will need their help. And they help me for the same reason. Because both parties gain. That's the kind of dependency that we used to have in this country. It's not the unhealthy slave collar dependency of the welfare mother with six kids, all of whom have different fathers. That's slave dependency. Counting on your neighbor to pitch in and help you when there's a storm, to move the debris out of your yard, and you pitch in and help them move the debris out of theirs, that's the kind of dependency that this country was built on. Voluntary dependency on one another as decent, caring human beings. Not dependency on a benevolent, all-wise government that regulates you into a corner so you can't do anything but be dependent. And that's the climate and the atmosphere of the equal outcomes instead of equal opportunities mentality of our public education system. My friend Linda said that's the way we need to go back to, in a good way, when everything melts down. And she's quite right. And that is probably what will happen. If we do have to live through the worst case scenario that many people envision, with a huge economic collapse, a multiplier of the Great Depression in this country to asymptotic levels, to a power of a Googleplex, then we will be forced to go back to that kind of dependency because it will be the only way we can survive. And we will do it because we will understand that if we help one another, we can all make it through. If we fort up and shoot everybody, okay, then nobody's going to come and help us when we run out of ammunition. There may be times when we all might have to ford up to fight off those who don't believe in that kind of dependency, who believe that you have something I want, so it's my right to take it from you. We may have to defend ourselves and those things that we have from that kind of entitlement mentality. If everything goes to hell in a handbasket, as some people predict it will. But the human race is resilient, and the human spirit is unconquerable. Because, after all, we are created in the image of our Creator. We too are creative. We too are adaptive. We too are innovative. We can and will and do build back up when things are smashed down. We have done it over and over and over and over again throughout history. As civilizations and societies fall, new ones rise atop them. They reach their heydays, they decline and fall, and new societies and new civilizations and new ways of doing things arise on top of them. We are not going to be able to create a perfect world, ladies and gentlemen. Because perfection is stagnation. That which is perfect has no need ever to change or create or grow. It is in stasis. It remains exactly as it is, always. God is perfect, but thank God we are not. And I believe that our Creator smiles when he hears that. Because as his children, he, she, it, or they know that the spark that makes us is not intended to make us perfect. It is intended to give us the energy to try to be better. What else could a parent ask of his or her child than that they are able to teach them or imbue them with the desire to try to be better? When we decide that we can become God, as progressives apparently believe we can, by just regulating and snipping here and pruning there and allowing to die out there and eugenically modifying someplace else and regulating here and making a law there and nudging in this direction and behavioral psychology applied to create an autonomic response of bad, bad, when you think we will eventually get to be God, is another illustration of why all progressives are fundamentally not sane. Liberalism is a mental disorder, is quite true. It is, at least as practiced by progressives. Because it presupposes that perfection is attainable if we just let them have all the power they want. Well, their definition of perfection and mine apparently are radically different. Because the kind of perfection that they want for me is something that I will run like hell to get away from. I kind of like my flaws as much as I like my good character points. Flaws. I have temper, impatience with stupidity, refusal to give in and let somebody convince me that what's good for me is what. Alive. Without desire, without a motivation to continue, we would all just lie down, every single one of us. If there is no hope, the progressive idea is people who are in despair, too physically comfortable to recognize it. And that is the pathetic side of the progressive ideas. The pathetic side of progressive ideas is the assumption that perfection can be achieved and the definition of perfection in the progressive mind. Perfection to the progressive is the perfectly operating engine in which every part meshes neatly with every other part and everything grinds along smoothly over and over and over again without change, without need for improvement, without any responsibility on the part of the cogs in the machine. Only the person at the control board has responsibility, and that person is sure that all will be well because every machine part knows its job. and will be replaced if it does not. And the small hitches that it takes to remove a part and put one in is a small price to pay for the machine returning to its usual efficient speed. That kind of perfection, ladies and gentlemen, I have no desire to experience. And I have no desire to teach that as a goal to my children, either my own grandchildren or the children I work with in school. There is a children's novel called A Wrinkle in Time by a lady named Madeline Bengel. And it's quite often used as a required novel in the late elementary and early middle school age groups. In it, one of the main characters, a young girl named Meg, who is always in trouble at school because she doesn't fit. She's brilliant mathematically, not so much so in the liberal arts area, has no patience, isn't pretty, is awkward, has scientists for parents, one of whom, her father, has disappeared. And she and her young brother and a boy she likes from school are plummeted into an adventure, a frightening adventure, seeking her father, trying to rescue him from imprisonment on a distant planet. And at one point in the story, when they have tried and failed to rescue him once, she is sent back to try again. And the guides on their journey, one of them tells her, they all give her something to take with her on the journey. And one of them says, I give you your faults. Because the place in which her father is imprisoned is the progressive utopia, in which everyone reacts exactly as they should to every stimulus. Everyone has his own niche. Everyone does exactly what he is supposed to do at exactly the time he is supposed to do it. Even the children bounce their balls in rhythm. And it is Meg's faults of impatience and anger and the unwillingness to be stuffed into a box into which she will not fit that give her the courage to say no and break free of the controlling mind of that progressive utopia. Our faults, our humanity, is both our flaw and our saving grace, ladies and gentlemen. Justifiably, we should embrace the fact that we are all different in our public schools. We should encourage our children to understand and accept that not everyone is the same. But that should not mean that everyone is equally incapable of doing anything on his own. Enjoying true diversity is part of being a loving, caring, viable, creative human being. But the diversity that's being taught in our schools is not true diversity. It's pap. It's feel-good garbage that says, oh, I can't have an opinion because it might offend somebody. I have a right to say what I want to say, but you don't have the right to disagree with me. Because if you do, you're insulting me and putting me down and making me feel bad. I have the right to an education, which means I have the right to straight A's even if I don't know anything, because I'll feel bad if my report card isn't as good as the guy who studies 8 hours a night. It is diversity held up as an ideal as everybody tries to totally eliminate its existence. This is why I tell you over and over and over again that our teachers and administrators in public schools are living in an oxymoron. They are told that they must provide equal opportunity to everyone and ensure equal outcomes to everyone. And you can't do it. Not with real, live human children. You can do it with machine-made counters in a board game. You can do it with parts of a reciprocating engine that are all made to the same specifications and are interchangeable. You can do it to machines, ladies and gentlemen, but you can't do it to people. And progressive educational thought is machine thought. It has absolutely nothing to do with people. All you have to look at is the number of tests that your kids have to take in the course of an academic year. You just look at the number of tests they're required to take. Not for their benefit, but so that the school can provide data to these certifying agencies paid by the government to determine whether or not they are accredited and allowed to continue to teach your kids. That is what they mean by data-driven education. It means turning your child into an old-fashioned punch card that will go through the IBM machine without causing a breakdown. Finding a niche in which to put your child. And then telling you that all is well because he is exactly what he is supposed to be to fit into the great societal machine. That is the end result of equal opportunity versus equal outcomes. The two are mutually exclusive, ladies and gentlemen. You're never going to get equal outcomes no matter what you try to do, but we can have and do have and have a history of providing equal opportunity. And that is the amazingly brilliant innovation that our founding fathers gave us. And as Franklin said when he was asked, what kind of government did you give us? A republic. If we can keep it. Thank you for joining us tonight, ladies and gentlemen, for Patriot Education. And thanks to my friends, Yo and Linda in the chat room from Patriot Families and all of you out there listening in. I hope you'll join me again next week on Thursday here on Blog Talk Radio for Patriot Education at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And I hope you'll join us every single night of the week for one of our great radio shows, brought to you by Patriot Families. We have something for everyone every night here on Blog Talk, ladies and gentlemen. Search the Blog Talk site for the Patriot Families show list. Join us. Visit us in chat. Call in to express your views and visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. We'd love to hear what you're thinking and what you're doing to preserve this beautiful republic that Dr. Franklin and his brilliant cohorts gave us. Have a wonderful evening, folks. We'll see you next week. God bless you all, and love to my dearest fam. Good night.